Support comes from Stanford Continuing Studies with a wide range of on-campus and online courses in liberal arts and sciences, creative writing, and professional development. Learn something new in the new year. Registration is underway with most classes beginning January 16th. Continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt with NPR, sitting in for Michael Krasny this week. In 1975, when he was 19 years old, Marvin Mutch was convicted of murder. He didn't leave prison until 41 years later. It took the efforts of students working on a wrongful conviction project and a series of lawyers to finally win his release. A new KQED News documentary, The Trials of Marvin Mutch, looks at the circumstantial evidence that landed Mutch behind bars, his life in prison, and what his case says about the parole system and criminal justice.
The problem with Marvin is he's never admitted to the crime. Well, if you don't admit to it, you'll never get out.
It was one of those situations where they had no other real leads.
And I have never seen a case go down where there was so little evidence against the perpetrator.
They said on the record that until you can explain to us how and why you did this, you're never getting out.
The justice system doesn't always get it right.
Adam Grossberg and Alex Emsley of KQED produced the film and the podcast that accompanies it. And they join us now to talk about their film, Marvin's Life, and what his story says about justice in America. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So let's get right into his trial a little bit. I mean, in the film, Mutch's lawyer says, you know, this man's whole life was stolen by the state of California. Set the stage for us. He was convicted when he was 18 of killing a 13-year-old, Cassie Riley, in a park not far from where he lived.
Yeah, he was. And a lot of that, and this is not incredibly uncommon in murder trials in California throughout the country. He was convicted solely on circumstantial evidence. There wasn't anything that directly showed that he had been there, that he had committed this crime. But there was a lot of pieces out there that connected, looked at in a certain way. You could infer that maybe he was the one who was guilty. And that's what a jury of 12 people did find in 1975.
So no DNA, no fingerprints. It was the conditions that the prosecution pieced together to win this conviction.
Yes. And in fact, there's sort of a dramatic moment in that trial. The prosecution's closing argument included sticking puzzle pieces onto a large board of all of these 16 pieces of circumstantial evidence as he tied them together to attempt to convince the jury of Marvin Mutch's guilt.
41 years. I mean, he comes from a troubled family, the film makes clear, a history of some mental illness, poverty. His dad wasn't around. Talk a little bit about what life was like for him before this conviction.
Yeah, he, you know, his family was a broken family. His parents were divorced. His mom had, you know, physical and mental health issues. So much of Marvin's childhood was spent in foster care, kind of in various foster homes, bouncing around quite a bit. He didn't really have any direction. He's described in, you know, his case file that we found, he's described as a lost child. He was raised in a chaotic environment. So, you know, with that comes, you know, normal juvenile delinquency. He got into some minor trouble. So that was his childhood.
His lawyer says in the film, you know, I look at his file and see a lost foster kid, not a murderer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And she, you know, she points to this background as, you know, contributing to his run-ins with the law. Marvin told us a story about, you know, in these foster homes, there were numerous times when everyone in the foster homes would be lined up whenever there was a crime committed in the area. So law enforcement immediately went to these foster homes to look for suspects.
Some of these were, it's not always clear, there's differences in some of these places he was housed, right? Foster homes versus then sometimes group homes versus then
shelters
and detention facilities. And the Chronicle recently has taken a deep look. I guess you guys talked about that recently.
Talked about it yesterday on the air. Yeah, indeed. We're talking with KQED News video producer Adam Grossberg and KQED News reporter Alex Emsley about their documentary that's just coming out, The Trials of Marvin Mutch. You can join the conversation at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook or at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. And we should mention we have a link to the film and podcast on the website, kqed.org/forum. forum. Guys, Marvin's sister, I watched the film last night, you know, she called the police thinking Marvin might have been a witness to this. She thought she was helping the police solve a case. Take us through what happens, because she becomes kind of the linchpin here.
Yeah. And so there, someone had been seen near the scene of this murder before it had occurred, half an hour before it had occurred. But they weren't identified at the time. A man in a beige uniform, possibly a gas station attendant, turned out to be a security guard, driving a Lincoln Continental, light-colored Lincoln Continental. And the police department, after a little more than a week of investigating Cassie Riley's classmates, other kids in the neighborhood, had kind of hit a dead end, and they released a description of this person, specifically saying, and they released these details to the newspaper, who then printed them, that they were seeking a witness, possibly the last person to have seen Cassie Riley alive. His 16-year-old sister, Valerie, who was home at the time playing sort of a surrogate mother to two younger half-sisters that they had. Their mother was absent at the time, in hospitalized. Saw the newspaper article and thought, well, the police need something that Marvin saw to be able to put their case together. They need to talk to them. She made that phone call. It was a very quick progression of events, a matter of a couple of hours from when she made that phone call to when the police were serving a search warrant at their home and Marvin was in custody.
We have a clip of tape about Marvin's sister. Let's take a listen.
So for me, it was like, oh my God, Marvin knows something and doesn't even know he knows it. So I called the police and told them that the person in the newspaper was my brother.
No, the police went over, and then in discussions at the house, she said, oh, he came home wet at some point. His hair was wet, his clothes were wet and muddy. He had muddy shoes on.
The sister thought she was providing information about her brother being in the park that day as a witness to what happened. She never believed he was capable of murder.
They came to the house, and it went from he might know something to he did something. And then someone said that Marvin had been picked up. When I called, I was like being the good citizen. If I could take my knowledge and go back, I would have never made that decision, ever.
So, Alex, the sister ended up in juvenile hall, and a member of the prosecution sort of took her in. Talk about this, because she became then kind of the star for the prosecution.
Yeah, there's a couple of points there, and one of them was very surprising for me to find out working in criminal justice reporting, police reporting, covering trials. I personally had never come across a situation where a person who ended up being a critical witness to a prosecution case was housed with a member of the prosecution team. This is Valerie Mutch. She's 16 years old, and after she had made this phone call, Marvin is no longer in the picture. Her mother does come home, and it's a bad situation, I think, at the household. Mm-hmm. She's being blamed for Marvin's arrest. She feels like she's broken up the family. She attempted suicide, took a handful of pills and wandered into school. She didn't die. She survived. But since then, she was in juvenile hall and then taken into the custody. But what she thought was to a new foster home with the district attorney's investigator, where she stayed for a few months until she testified in the trial.
But essentially, she was living with a DA's investigator, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And she told us that during these few months living with that family, that the trial, you know, the case of her brother, who he was awaiting trial, that the case was discussed with her. And she was essentially coached. And what they were trying to get her to say in the end was that Marvin came home on the day of Cassie Riley's murder and he was wet and muddy.
Isn't that potentially prosecutorial misconduct, interfering with a witness? What'd you guys find out?
I mean, it could be. At least one attorney, the public defender involved in this case, put it this way. It's not on its face a violation of law for that to have happened, but through discovery, through Valerie's testimony when she was on the stand. There are multiple points in the trial where that information probably should have been disclosed to the defense and to the jury.
So and it
that
simply
they could
wasn't.
Make, it wasn't, and we do have documentation that that wasn't for a lack of trying, I think, by Marvin Mutch's public defender. There is consistent argument throughout pretrial and even up into during Valerie's testimony where he's trying to get the court to allow her to disclose where she has been. But it never makes it to the jury. We spoke to one of the jurors. He's included in the film, John McQueary, who had a strong reaction to that. He said if he had known that, it would have changed his evaluation of Valerie Mutch's testimony, what she was saying, and how he would interpret it.
Brad writes, in hearing stories like this, it becomes increasingly clear the criminal justice system needs a top-to-bottom reassessment. I personally have experienced it. People outside of it really have no idea. End quote. And I guess I want to ask you guys, stepping back, this is a compelling story of one man who served 41 years, circumstantial evidence, key information was withheld at the trial. But how much is this representative of the larger picture, to getting to Brad's point?
I think it absolutely is. And maybe more than his conviction and his time in prison, the last chapter of Marvin's story is his release. Hmm. And I think what that shows is California's prison system reforming itself and making it possible for someone like Marvin Mutch to actually be released.
Hmm. We're talking with KQED News video producer Adam Grossberg and news reporter Alex Emsley about their new documentary, The Trials of Marvin Mutch. It says a lot about the criminal justice system, the parole system. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And you guys got great access to him. The film has these poignant moments of Marvin adjusting to life on the outside after 41 years in prison, including shopping for a phone. And he says at one point, you know, none of this existed in 1974, none of it. We have a clip of him, I believe, getting an apartment. Let's take a listen.
I'm moving into my very first townhome. It's my very first residence that actually I have my name on a lease. And this is the key. I haven't had anything like that before.
Haven't had anything like that before. Alex, tell me about the access you got to him.
Well, that's Adam is probably more suited to answer that question, but I can just say that I know it took a lot of time, you know, to develop a level of trust that he would be willing to share these things. Marvin doesn't want to talk about this crime a lot.
Yeah, that's right. And so just stepping back, I met Marvin, you know, on the day of his release at the prison gates of California Medical Facility where he finished his time and was released. I met him on that day, hadn't spoken to him before, was put in contact with him through, you know, a couple other contacts. And it started out as we were just going to document his first day and then his first week. And then, you know, it kept growing as we learned more about who Marvin was, what his story was, and the process of just spending time with him. And the access just kind of grew as he got more and more comfortable with me and then later with Alex. So, yeah, we were just around and kind of in constant contact with him for months.
And I won't give it all away, but there's some poignant moments in the film where he has his access to parole. He served 41 years, and he keeps getting turned down. Let's go to Richard in Oakland for his question or comment. Richard, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say that as long as we retain the adversarial system that we've had ever since Hammurabi, we're not going to really have a just system. And the basic problem, as I see it, is nobody is trying to ascertain what's so. There's a thing called the truth, what actually happened. And as long as we've got this adversarial system, the prosecution, it's all about winning and losing.
Well, thanks, Richard. I appreciate your point. It's well taken. Alex, the adversarial system is a cornerstone of the justice system.
Well, it is. It has not always been in even in, you know, on, I guess, this continent or this country, the United States, we did have a transplant system from Britain that was the inquisitorial system at one point. That was replaced by the adversarial system, believed to be, you know, more fair. But I think I want to talk about that idea of prosecution, the discretion that prosecutors have, and the ethics that come into play that we hope, I think the system hopes will balance that, right? So the idea, the caller mentioned, who is seeking the truth in these matters? Well, the police, when they're doing their investigation, supposedly should be looking at everything with sort of an unbiased lens, trying to find exactly who did it without any other motivations. The prosecutors then, if they do not believe that the person whose case has been presented to them actually committed the crime, they're ethically bound to discharge that case, to not pursue it to conviction. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point. I mean, the person who prosecuted this case almost about three decades later did question whether the evidence was strong enough to have resulted in a conviction. Mm-hmm. So even prosecutors living with a case for a long time can start to see it a different way.
Mm-hmm. And Adam, I wanted to ask you, did you reach out at all to the family of the victim, the family of Cassie Riley?
We did. We spoke to Cassie Riley's closest living relative, her first cousin. And Deborah Morgan is her name. And she actually... she was the same age as Cassie, so at the time of Cassie's death, she was very young and didn't really remember the case. Around 2000, she actually became interested in it and did some research, you know, actually ordered the trial transcripts, read them, came out. She lives in Texas. She flew out here to Cassie's grave and actually corresponded with Marvin while he was in prison. So they had a brief back and forth, and then she eventually ended up appearing at his last parole hearing in 2015. She appeared and spoke on his behalf and supported his release, said, "We'll never know for sure whether or not he did this, but regardless, he's served more than his fair share of time, and he should be released."
Interesting. She showed up at the parole hearing. And yep. Some believe a former boyfriend of Cassie's who was allegedly in the park that night may have been involved. He's now, as I understand it, on death row for some heinous crimes, including sexual assault crimes. Did the DA look into that possibility in depth?
I do not know the depth to which the Alameda County District Attorney's Office looked into the possibility of whether James DeVeggio, who is this person who is now on death row for other crimes, including a murder, was responsible for Cassie Riley's death. I know that he was interviewed during the original investigation in late 1974, but was not at that time considered a suspect. He gave some very basic information, and that's really the only mention of him in the case file. There was further attention to the possibility that he could be involved in this crime around 2000, and the district attorney's office told us that they looked into that and determined that that was not possible.
He's currently on death row for murder. Interesting.
That's right.
Marvin is out now. Tell us a little bit about how he's doing today and what he's up to. But let me just give out the number one more time. We're talking about criminal justice and the new documentary from KQED, The Trials of Marvin Much. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Tell us what he's up to today.
So Marvin's been out about a year and 3 or 4 months. We leave off in the film after 6 months. So, you know, in that time, he has moved out of the mandated transitional home. He's moved into his first apartment, like we heard. He's gotten married. He's kind of living a normal life, but he is still struggling with, you know, finding work. He lives in the Bay Area. It's very expensive. So, you know, the normal struggles of paying rent, finding work are the things that he's now dealing with.
And Alex?
He has but part of that is that he has a particular thing that he really wants to do for his employment. He has a drive. He has goals to work on criminal justice policy. He does believe that he has a strong, you know, insight that a lot of other people maybe don't have that could be a benefit to, you know, the massive amount of complicated things that the state struggles with all the time in terms of incarceration and crime.
And in San Quentin, he was involved in trying to help prisoners' grievances. Yeah?
It's an outgrowth of what he became in prison after about the first 20 years that he was there. He really adopted this advocacy role. He's rule crazy, I think. He's very literal in his interpretation. It's probably an impact of the prison environment as well. He became very skilled at using those rules and interpreting them to try to fight for his rights and the rights of other inmates that were somewhat, you know, guaranteed by these regulations but not always followed.
Well, it sounds like he might want to become a lawyer. I mean, following the rules. And he's looking for work, for employment right now, is he?
Yeah, he's doing some contract work for advocacy groups, for, you know, he's done some lobbying work, he does speaking engagements. So he is very involved in criminal justice advocacy work. He's kind of continuing what he did inside, now on the outside.
And talk a little bit about the parole system. You know, he was originally sentenced to, I think, 7 years to life.
That's right.
41, went up for parole so many times. He keeps getting put back. Talk a little bit about what this case says about the parole system.
It shows that system, like the prison system and a lot of what we try to look at in this film, has evolved over time from the time that he went to prison to the time he was actually released. In 1975, when Marvin Much was convicted, he was sentenced under a law, an indeterminate sentencing law. So most sentences had this range, and many of them any number of years to life. That means that the parole authorities would have to determine that a person was suitable for release before they were released. Just a couple of years after Marvin was sentenced, that law changed to a determinate sentencing law, but those were generally, you can see those as like mandatory minimum type sentencing, right? So it ended up on the whole increasing the amount of years people served. That system was in place for a long time, and the California prison population saw a 500% increase between, you know, the mid-70s and the early 2000s, up to 160,000, more than 160,000 inmates at one time at its high point. It's down to now about 130,000 because in somewhat more recent years, there's been a shift. Mm-hmm. More people being lighter sentences on the front end, realignment to county jails. And a big one is California Supreme Court decisions that said the heinousness of a person's crime should not eliminate their potential for parole. That becomes a de facto life sentence without the possibility of parole. So,
right. On paper, the parole board is not supposed to look at that and say, are you admitting guilt? They're supposed to look at other factors. Have you served your sentence? How have you been as a prisoner, etc.? But your film finds out that in reality, it did look at that.
Yeah, and this is before recent reforms, but there is a California state law that says the parole board cannot require an admission of guilt when, you know, determining an inmate is suitable for parole. Marvin's case, he didn't ever, and for much of his time in prison, he didn't admit guilt to the crime. Mm-hmm. So because of that, he was just kind of told outright by several commissioners and deputy commissioners at these parole hearings, until you admit guilt, we're not going to release you.
Well, we can take some more phone calls. Edric in Sacramento, what's your question? You're on forum. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I came to this Sacramento about 10 years ago, and shortly before that, someone was there was a bus accident on a group of going to a casino near here, and the driver fell asleep. 10 people were killed, and the guy was condemned to 27 years in prison, I think. I don't remember the name, but it's been on my mind ever since, because 27 years for a crime that is a crime of negligence, but not 1 ounce of premeditation, not 1 ounce of criminal intent, seems to be outrageously out of size.
Valid point. Valid point about a long sentence with no criminal intent. Marvin Much did 41 years.
And that's what I really – that's what I hope – people can start to think about and examine if they look at and think about Marvin Much's story. Mm-hmm. What I have somewhat always suspected in some ways, but really became clear to me through reporting this story, is that there's been a lot of pendulum shifts in criminal justice policy and harsh sentences versus rehabilitation in this country over these 40 years. And then, of course, you can go back further and into, you know, present day today. So all of these types of decisions have consequences. We are seeing from the Washington, D.C., from federal direction right now, a shift toward stronger minimum sentences for federal prosecutions. And I think that the federal and the state systems are sort of irrevocably intertwined. They take cues from each other. So we might see, again, a shift toward stronger, harsher sentences. And I think then that has an impact on people. That is what we set out to show.
Adam Grossberg, a listener, writes in on social media, is Marvin bitter? How do you serve 41 years thinking you're innocent and not become an angry man? Talk about his what he's like today.
Yeah, that is actually one of the more astonishing, you know, parts of Marvin's personality, is that he doesn't seem to harbor that kind of bitterness and resentment that, you know, so many of us would. He's generally optimistic. He sees the best in people. He tells us he's not, you know, he just wants to get his story out and let it be known that these kinds of things happen. Mm-hmm. He's not out to, you know, seek revenge or, you know, point the fingers. He just wants his story told. And, you know, the fact that he has been through as much as he has and still kind of is himself and still, you know, not broken by these experiences, I think is pretty telling about who he is.
A listener tweets at us, our criminal justice system and mass incarceration in America is a humanitarian crisis to which we are turning a blind eye. Your piece really says a lot about the justice system in California and beyond. You guys going to follow up with Marvin? Is this the end of the story? Where does it go?
We will continue to follow up with Marvin, and you mentioned this is also a podcast series that will continue to play out for at least another month. In general, it's not just Adam and I. We have colleagues at KQED that have a strong focus on county jails, on immigration enforcement, and the state prison system. We're having a screening of this film next week to talk about where the parole system – there will be a panel after the screening that will look at where the parole system is going and where California criminal justice is headed next.
We've been talking with KQED News video producer Adam Grossberg, KQED News reporter Alex Emsley, about their new documentary, The Trials of Marvin Mutch. A free screening of the film plays June 1st at 5 p.m. at the Oakland Museum of California. And you can find a link to the movie and to the KQED podcast at trialsofmarvinmutch.org. That's trialsofmarvinmutch.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Eric Westervelt, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.
The Bay Area is at the forefront of social justice, but it's also a place where deep inequality can exist. Cued Up takes these issues and frames them through real stories of real people. Search QED Up wherever you get your podcasts.